We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Here's a summer travel tip. Pack just one pair of shoes that goes with every outfit, like the versatile, perfectly packable tree shoes from Allbirds. Find your pair of Tree Dashers 2, Runners, Pipers, and more at Allbirds.com. That's Allbirds.com.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show with accomplished chess players, authors, personalities, and adult improvers where they discuss their lives, their careers, and share tips about how to improve at chess. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. So without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We are here with an oft-requested return guest. He is the two-time British champion and an award-winning author. He's also shown great longevity as a competitor near the top of the chess world. He's currently ranked number 42 in the world at, I believe, the age of 47.
That's
his books. Good. I forgot to fact check. His books, Game Changer and Chess for Life, were both co-authored with Natasha Regan and are both favorites of this podcast. You can hear us discuss them in episode 112. He, of course, also has written many other fantastic books. His new one, The Silicon Road to Chess Improvement, goes beyond just talking about AlphaZero, as Game Changer famously did, and extracts lessons for humans from many of the other super engines. He's also a book reviewer for New in Chess magazine. He's been covering the world championship for Kasparov Chess with Kasparov himself. So there is lots to talk about, and we have lots of great listener questions to dig into. But first, let's welcome Grandmaster Matthew Sadler back to Perpetual Chess. Welcome, Matthew.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
Yeah, excited to have you on. As we were just saying, there's so much to talk about, Matthew. But what I'd like to begin with is we've got to get some time management tips from you. And by time management, I don't just mean chess clock management, but I mean, how do you do so much stuff? It's just amazing. Like, what's your secret to being so productive?
I guess the point is that I'm really only doing stuff that I really enjoy. You know, I mean, with chess, you know, I'm analyzing continually, I guess. You know, I mean, I'm watching a lot of engine games all the time on the TCC, and I'm analyzing them continually. And then, you know, at some stage it just sort of builds up, and then you've got lots of stuff that you can present at once. You know, it's all to do with enjoyment, really. You know, I don't rely on chess for my, you know, as my job. I have a full-time job, so you know, it's I don't need to do anything you know, particularly commercial either. I can just you know, publish information and or publish videos or write some articles when I, you know, when I feel like it, and it doesn't really matter to me. And I think that's, you know, it's a lovely freedom. I mean, obviously I was professional for quite a while before. You know, I've experienced the other side of it, and but I have to say I much prefer it this way. I mean, I love chess. I can't get away from it. You know, it's my very favorite way of spending my free time. And but you know, in this way I just get to do what I want, and then, yeah, you know, if I fancy publishing it, I do it when I like, you know. So it's a dream, really, you know, from my point of view.
Yeah, and your enthusiasm definitely comes across in everything that you do. Now, Matthew, right before we hit record, you did confess to me, though, that for your non-chess work in IT, you work 4 days a week, right?
That's right. Yeah.
So that, for any listeners wondering, that's a small bit of the mystery. Because even for your new In Chess review, which is your book reviews, which are indispensable, you're reading like five books per month, it appears. That in itself, as someone who reads a lot of chess books, I'm impressed.
Yeah, that is quite a bit of work actually. Normally I read just a little bit more, and then I really only try to review books that that I particularly like. All books that are thought-provoking, I might not like them so much, but they really, I feel like, they really made me think, again, from that point of view, if it was, just a sort of dull drudgery, then, I think you'd probably stop quite quickly. But the quality of books that comes out nowadays is so good. Every single book, I'm learning something new and seeing something interesting, whether it's about an opening or a great old player or old events or the middle game or anything. There's just so much fantastic information at the moment that again, it just remains a pleasure to keep on reading books.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Time is the only constraint, really. It's not the number of books to read. So again, I have a sense of this from reading your reviews, but what are some of your recent favorites, Matthew?
Oh, there's quite a few, actually. I think one that I want to mention is Winning by Nigel Short, and maybe give him a shout out because he's in hospital at the moment with COVID. So big shout out to Nigel. Keep on fighting. Hope you get better soon. I mean, what I liked about the book actually was the structure. That Nigel just took tournaments where he'd won and sort of gave the good, the bad, and the ugly, really. That was something where I read it and I sort of thought, I wish I'd read this when I was younger. Because I got very upset, when I was playing. Often when I was playing good tournaments, if I played a bad game, and I thought, what's happening? This doesn't sort of fit into my great tournament. But Nigel's just showing that even in a great tournament, the great successes of his career, there were moments where he played less well, moments where he played badly, where things went wrong. But still, the overall impression was very, very positive. And, I think that's an enormously important practical lesson. And that was one of the things where I thought, if I'd read that when I was young, that would have been really, really useful. Other books that I've loved, the books on Bogolyubov by Elkin Ruby. I love those. I mean, Bogolyubov's a big, a player I really like a lot. And, I wrote quite a few articles about his games on my blog at the time. And they've done a lovely job of presenting all his games and also, getting together what the strengths of his play were. Because, He was sort of a player who grew up in the era of great champions, Capablanca, Lasker, Alekhine, and in comparison to those, of course, your play pales. It's never going to look so impressive, but somehow these books really brought out what his strengths were. Enormous optimism, a great all-round game, good feel for the initiative, for the time, a great a very not deep opening knowledge, but broad opening knowledge. He could play pretty much anything. And I think when I was 10 or 11, I just, looked at Bogolyubov's results in the World Championships and thought, oh, loser, don't want to be like that. Having been a chess professional, having, struggled so hard and, to get where I got, which was, sort of top 20, you understand really, how great the skill involved was in there. And you appreciate players like that a lot better. And, and that's one of the beautiful things nowadays. People are bringing out books about players like that. And you can really appreciate, these kind of lesser known players, to their full extent. And, he really played some wonderful games as well, Bogolyubov. So that was a very nice game. And I think just the final one to mention is a book by Jan Timman, who's just been on the show, actually, but The Unstoppable American. And I thought that was a wonderful book because, it's all about this realism. It's the same thing that you had with Nigel's book, because, you sort of look back on, how did Bobby achieve all his wonderful results? And you sort of assume that it was just very smooth. He just won all those games and nobody could resist him. But the number of games in which he was struggling, in which there were long grinds to victory and all that, it's when you see it in context, it really gives you an idea of this was a human being, who just got himself together in an incredible way. You know, in order to play at a very high level, but it wasn't smooth. You know, it wasn't plain sailing. And again, I think those are very valuable lessons, you know, for young players to take away, you know, to get a realistic idea about what you need, what's it costs in order to get to the top. And, you know, I think that when I was young, I didn't really have that very good sense of it. And I maybe thought at times that things were way too difficult or should be too easy somehow, you know. And I think books like this really give a very good impression of what it takes to become the best.
Yeah, it was interesting to read that even the legendary Taimanov 6-0 air quotes wipeout, the games were quite competitive.
They were great. They were really good. I mean, Taimanov was a very interesting player. You know, I mean, a little bit fragile, flaky, you could say, but, you know, maximum strength was very, very high, you know. And but again, you know, it was just amazing how you know, Bobby at the critical moments of the game, he was able to marshal himself and give you know, absolute 100% concentration, you know. And and probably that's something that, you know, Taimanov just couldn't quite manage to the same extent, you know. And and that's why all those, and, you know, I mean, just Taimanov was incredibly unlucky, of course, that all the crucial moments turned against him somehow. You know, every single time Bobby managed to to find something and turn it around, not just from a, you know, from a worse position to a draw, but to a win for him, you know. And and, you know, from that point of view, I think when we look at the recent performance of Magnus against Jan, I think we're seeing exactly the same thing, you know.
Yeah, that was a point that Jan Timman highlighted it as well. I mean, if you just look at chess styles, Fischer wouldn't necessarily be the first comp to Carlsen, but because of their ability, their competitive drive, their ability to win the tight games stands out for sure.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think if you look at this match, I think, you know, what I really felt was the big difference was Magnus's experience in World Championship matches. Because, I mean, you have a look just at the chances that both players had. You know, Magnus had chances, you know, a tiny one in game 6, and then bigger ones in games 8, 9, and 11. And he scored 4 out of 4. And Jan had chances in games 2 and game 6 and scored 0.5 out of 2. And, you know, you sort of feel that, you know, the difference there was that, you know, Magnus, you know, he's been in lots of world championships. He's got, I think, you know, now a sort of intuitive, emotional sense of when the critical moments in a match are. And at those moments, you know, he knows that he has to marshal himself 100% in order to make the most of it, because opportunities in world championships are few and far between. And I mean, you know, the games that he won, you know, 8, 9, 11 were, you know, relatively simple chances. But still, if you look at the execution, you know, once he got it to a technical end game, the quality of execution there, you couldn't have got much better from Stockfish. I mean, really, you know, I was looking at the evaluations from Sessi, you know, this this Norwegian, very strong hardware that analyzes the games. And, you know, it's just increasing move by move, you know, the evaluation, which I can tell you is very, very unusual. You know, it's a really high class of technique, which means that his concentration was extremely high there. You know, and then you look at Jan the chances that he had game 2, which was, you know, actually a very good chance, and game 6. I mean, game 2 was very complicated, a very strange position, but it is the type of position that you'd say, okay, if Jan's going to beat Magnus, that would be the one I'd give him, right? I mean, but you sort of felt that that Jan kept on playing at sort of normal world championship intensity. You know, he didn't. And, you know, really that feeling of this is it, this is my moment, this is where everything I've got has got to go on the table. You know, looking back at the moves, they feel sort of a little loose, I guess, you know, just not quite the same quality as Magnus at those moments. And I think that was really the, you know, for me, that was the big difference between the two players.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I agree. And of course, you were doing a lot of work with your engines in conjunction. You made a few videos sort of going down rabbit holes of various positions working with the super engines. And I know we had briefly mentioned before we started recording, you saw Peter Hein Nielsen's game recap, match recap with I.M. Sagar Shah of Chess Base India, as I mentioned in last week's interview with Erwin Lemay, definitely a must watch. But it was interesting to me that Peter found time to sort of to look through some of the engine games you'd shared, the engine on engine in various positions. So how did it feel to find that out? And were you in like direct contact with Peter, or how did that come about?
No, not in direct contact with Peter, but I know that he follows the TCC games, the website where they did these games. He follows it quite closely. I mean, he's a big engine fan. I mean, I think when AlphaZero came out, that was really a big trigger for Peter. I mean, he really got very into the games, and I think that's the sign of a good trainer, right? I mean, something new comes along, and you think, right, okay, how can we use that, to get an advantage? And well, certainly, I think if you look at how Magnus played in 2019. And the types of games he played as well, I think he got some inspiration from the whole AlphaZero thing, which of course, that's the huge thing about Magnus. I think you can probably just show him an idea in just in 5 seconds, and then you can just apply it, just like that. But I'm not surprised that he was following the games. But he seemed really, really up to date with absolutely everything, which was very, very impressive indeed, Yeah, it was a very interesting thing to do. I mean, we talked, the TCC site, it's a site of volunteers, right? And they're just doing this all in their spare time and running these enormous tournaments. And we sort of discussed about, would it be interesting to kibitz during the match? But, somehow it felt like everyone else would be doing that. But this whole idea of taking critical positions from the match afterwards and then, replaying them with these superhuman strength engines, just to get a real sense of, what might have happened and what was the actual objective result, was fantastic. I mean, it's something that I've talked a lot about in the Silicon Road to Chess Improvement, this way of training. And it's the way basically that I've been analyzing more or less since started doing all the work on AlphaZero. And it's just such a powerful way of doing it, because if you just let an engine analyze just on one move, however deep you want to do it, still there's all this doubt about I can see this line 50 ply deep, but is it really going to happen? When the engines actually have to make decisions on moves, you see a whole game unfolding. You see the flow of the game. Quite apart from the moves themselves, you understand, does that look difficult for Black to play, or is that easy? All those sort of things, those sort of very human emotions come out of it. And if you run a match of 10 games, from similar positions, you get one game of each color, 20 games, and you just see that flow afterwards. You get a brilliant sense of when did a game turn, when was it too late, when did White still have chances, for example. It's all about it's really all about how can you use engines to give you those human feelings and emotions about games, and how can you have engine analysis that lives in your head rather than just being a wadge of text in Chessbase that you're trying to decipher, and trying to understand whether it works or not. And, what I found, probably that's part of getting a bit older as well, I enjoy long variations less. But what I enjoy very much are, evocative games, evocative variations, variations that aren't necessarily, the complete truth about a position, but that really capture the essence of what the position's about. Is it an attacking position? Is it a position where I should play positionally? And playing lots and lots of engine games like that is a lovely way to do it. And the TCC was fantastic. I mean, thanks to those games, you zoom in on something like game 6 and you see, well, Nepo could have taken twice on B4 on move 35 and move 36. And, with the engine games that were played, you could see very clearly that, well, move 35 taking on B4 was actually more or less drawn in a couple of ways. Then taking on move on B4 on move 36, that was really dangerous, but possibly still a draw, some ways to hold. Leela got very close to holding it against Stockfish, and Stockfish managed to hold it against Leela for Magnus, So, really amazing insights, that you get from that. And as I said, in the book and also in the supplementary material, trying to explain how you do that and also give the step-by-step instructions how to do it. And I can really, I really recommend it to absolutely everyone to work with engines in this way.
That's really interesting that even those moments that people highlighted in game six where Nepo near the first time control could have, again, air quotes, taken control may have been drawn. And Peter Hein-Nielsen, correct me if I'm wrong, but he also highlighted in the interview with Sagar that in game five, everyone was highlighting when Nepo didn't go C4 and C5 to sort of put the clamps down and achieve this bind. But I believe Peter also said that the engines were holding that for black.
Yeah, I mean, but that then becomes very interesting because then the sort of the human judgment comes in. I mean, after this move C4 in game or move 20 in game five, you know, the engines were holding it by playing this move, queen E6, which is a very odd move. It puts the queen opposite the light squared bishop, but pins this pawn on C4, so it can't advance. But you know, if I played a move like that in a game, it would be, you know, it would probably be the you know, the thing that I said, okay, well, I think I've got to do this, but I'm a little bit nervous, yeah. You know, and I think, you know, those are the things, of course, that you've also got to keep in mind, you know, when you look at all this fantastic engine analysis, is you've always got to keep the human perspective in mind of how difficult is this, you know, is this a move? Does this have, you know, any? Does this move that the engine wants? Does it have any characteristics that would make it, you know, difficult for me as a human to find? And you've never got to lose sight of that because you know, it's a very, in a way, the World Championship is very funny, right? Because, you know, you've got two human players with all their, you know, wonderful players, but with their frailties and their limited memories and calculating abilities, mm-hmm. analyzing for months and months beforehand with, you know, superhuman strength engines, and then afterwards having to, you know, take the battle not against a superhuman strength engine, not against objectivity or the objective truth of chess, but against another human being with all his frailties, you know, and this makes it, you know, there's I think, you know, probably the role of seconds in World Championship preparation has changed, you know, enormously, because I think, you know, beforehand, you know, just from my experiences analyzing in the being a second for Joël Luthier in the pre-computer age, you know, before you had a void and you had to fill that with ideas. And now you've just got a mass of data and you've just got to pick out promising ideas that a human opponent might have overlooked, ideas that, you know, contain poison that would be difficult for a human. It's a big translation, you know, that has to take place, and requires a lot of inventiveness, a lot of practical cunning, and you know, but a very different sort of creativity, I think, nowadays.
Yeah, it was interesting to me that Peter Hein-Nielsen again said that the days where seconds need to stay up all night are over because the engines are so strong that they can. It's more a matter of cultivating.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of you know, I mean, you really see a big shift. You know, I'd say pre AlphaZero to post AlphaZero. You know, that's probably not something that the engine guys particularly like if you describe it like that, but just from a, you know, from the practical chess player point of view, that's how it sort of feels. But, you know, you know, around 2017, you know, of course you were totally smashed by any of the engines, you know, they'd just been way stronger for so long, but you still had the idea that you had a lot to offer in terms of opening understanding and also positional understanding. You know, I mean, simply certainly in the opening, you know, Stockfish at the time somehow didn't quite have that the urgency that humans have in the opening. You know, the desire to make the most of the initial momentum that you have when you're developing your pieces, you know, and from that point of view, you know, Stockfish's general opening play was not that strong, you know, whereas of course the rest of its game was already at, you know, 3500 ELO strength. And then, and also, you know, for positional ideas, you often had the feeling, well, I understand this position better, you know, and what's being suggested here is not right. You know, you move to AlphaZero, and you know, AlphaZero sort of brought, you know, really two things. I think, you know, first of all, the realization that a lot of the, you know, the whole sacrificial area of the game, pawns for long term compensation, exchange sacrifices for long term compensation, that was, you know, a part of the game that we'd sort of thought, oh, that's probably not very good because every time we try it, you know, we just lose to Stockfish. But, you know, AlphaZero showed that was possible. And now, to be honest, if you look at engine games nowadays, they're just replete with sacrifices, you know, just all over the place. I mean, it's quite amazing. But the other thing that happened was that, you know, you suddenly realize that actually the engines, you know, AlphaZero was the first, of course, but it's all the engines nowadays. They're actually stronger than you in the opening and in the in positional play. They actually understand stuff a lot better than you. And that's, you know, something really, really interesting to think about, you know, why is that, and how could I emulate that? There has been just a huge shift, from, you know, from 2018 onwards, where essentially engines, I think, you know, just became much stronger at all parts of the game, you know, not just tactics and defense and, you know, and combinations.
Yeah, well, I think the question of how can I emulate them, that, let's be real, that's the question a lot of listeners want to know, because we're never going to calculate perfectly. We're always going to make mistakes. And certainly from having read and enjoyed the Silicon Road to Chess Improvement, I have my own conclusions that I could share. But first, I'd like to hear yours. So especially for club players, because obviously you've been an elite player for decades, so you're coming at it from a different perspective. But let's say below 2000, something like that. Can we still learn from like 3600 against 3600 engine games?
Yeah. I mean, the point is, you know, I mean, I am absolutely convinced that we should try and, you know, it shouldn't be a question of trying to make machines play human-like. We should be trying to play a bit more machine-like, but really on one specific area. And I mean, actually, Demis Hassabis said this to Natasha and I when we were writing Game Changer, but it didn't quite hit me until I heard a Leela Zero developer say something very similar. But you know, the major strength of the engines, an engine like Leela Zero, is in the evaluation. It's, you know, and calculation adds you know, maybe a quarter of its extra strength, but it's all about evaluation. You just take Leela. I mean, it's what I did in the Silicon Road. You know, I did this match against Leela where it calculates not a single move. It's just purely going on its evaluation. And well, I made, you know, sort of 78% or something against it, but you know, for something that's not calculating a single move in such a tactical game as chess, that's incredible. I mean, apparently I was talking to the Leela, to a very nice Leela guy who explains a lot to me. And, you know, he was saying that, well, they got stronger and stronger. Probably could expect that Leela, just evaluating, not calculating a single move, is something like 2,500, 2,550 strength. And, you know, and what they're working on continually is to make it, you know, even stronger, that it's, you know, elite GM strength without calculating a single move, just on evaluating the position. And, you know, it really made me think about, because, you know, in all my career, I have spent so many hours working at chess, but I have never consciously thought I need to work on my evaluation. I've practiced my tactics. I've, you know, practiced learning end games. I've worked hard on openings. I've looked at typical middle games. But I've never really thought about, you know, how do I improve my evaluation of positions? And, you know, again, that, you know, that struck me so much when I was then analyzing just normal quiet positions with AlphaZero and seeing that a lot of my evaluations were just off. You know, I was saying, "Oh, this must be you know, good for white," but it wasn't. Or this must be good for black, and it wasn't. And you know, just and then you do it. You know, you do it again with Leela, with Stockfish, and you see that that a lot of your evaluations are off from that point of view. And you know. Well, you know, I've been thinking a lot about, you know, why could this be, you know, and I frankly think that it's to do with all the terrible material that I grew up with, you know, because, you know, you look at all these at the books that you grew up with, and you know, many of them actually contain very bad analysis. I mean, you run them past the engine, and you know, half of the games have got huge tactical mistakes, and you know, even, you know, classic games in which they demonstrate, you know, the power of a weak complex of dark squares. You know, you put it on the engine, and the engine says, "Yeah, but you know, the opponent was winning until the end. It was just it was just something wrong." And somehow, you know, that hasn't affected you badly. You know, this bad material. I mean, somehow, you know, that incredible human ability to just abstract, you know, just the essence of something and not remember the details, you know, that's added to your knowledge, and that's made you strong. But I think, you know, what you learn from the engines is that, you know, you've got the The outer theme that you can see, like, you know, for example, an isolated queen's pawn or weak dark squares or whatever. But there's also, you know, a huge amount of stuff going inside that's not immediately visible. Like, I think, you know, the inner harmony of the pieces and the way that the pieces work together. And I mean, if you've ever, you can experiment with this yourselves. I've done it, and I saw, who was it who did it as well? Sam Shankland in his book on pawns. I'm not sure what the name is anymore, but great book on just focusing on pawns. And he was just moving pawns, you know, one square back, one square forward, or you move a piece, one square left, one square right. And it makes a massive difference to the position. You know, you could say that this game is all about a weak complex of dark squares, but move a knight in the position from g7 to f7. And suddenly, you know, the theme's completely different. The dark squares don't seem to be weak anymore. So there's this wonderful interaction, I think, you know, of the theme that you can see on the board, and also the inner workings, the inner harmony of the piece, you know, between the position and between the your pieces and the opponent's pieces. And I think that's what, you know, engines pick up really, really well. You know, they have this incredible, great sense of mobility and the way that pieces have to be placed. And I think that, you know, probably that's sort of something that you wouldn't pick up from bad examples, you know, that you looked at when you were young, because that was pretty random, really, whether that inner harmony of the pieces was good or not. It was all about demonstrating an outer theme. And I do think that young players nowadays, growing up with enormously high quality material on which, you know, if there's an example in a book, it's not only correct, you know, from the thematic point of view, but also from the, you know, from the tactical point of view as well. You know, I think they are going to be having, you know, much better evaluations than players of my generation, or much more sophisticated evaluations, you know. And and to be honest, you know, when I see games by Ali Reza, you know, recently, you know, I really have the feeling that this guy, you know, has you know, again, evaluation on a much higher level, you know. And it's not just about calculation or anything. It's just understanding where the pieces go, understanding how they burn through the board, you know, and show the most activity. And I mean, so that's something that, you know, I've been you know, thinking about that and thinking, oh, you know, how could you reprogram yourself? But I mean, you know, going back to what can people learn from it, you know, we don't need to look at calculation. What we need to look at is the core of the engines, really, the most impressive part. And that's how they evaluate positions. And I think there's an awful lot to learn, you know, from that.
Man, so many follow-ups, whether it be about Ali Reza, of course, who's fascinating. Let's start with that one. And by the way, I should say the Shanklin book is called Small Steps to Giant Improvement.
That's the one. Yes, that's the one.
Yeah. And of course, there's a sequel as well. But with Ali Reza, so you mentioned what you observed from going through his games. Do you see like an engine footprint? Do you think that these insights that he's able to derive that are sort of superior to a lot of his contemporaries are based on engine work from what you've seen, Matthew?
I think, yeah, I would definitely think, you know, I mean, it's, I think nowadays a player growing up is always influenced. I mean, whether it's working a lot with an engine or just using material that's been rigorously engine checked, you know, and is perfect in every way. But, you know, I just saw, you know, some games, you know, there was one against Erdos, I think it was recently in the European Team Championship, where he played this, you know, this artificial castling maneuver, King D7, C7, B8 in some sort of Caracan. And, I mean, I've also seen this quite a lot in engine games, these sort of artificial castling maneuvers. And it just makes everything perfect. You know, it just makes sense of the position. And then he followed up also by playing B5 and A5, you know, in front of his king. It's kind of that mixture of very concrete play, but also just this real understanding of where his pieces are going to be at their most active, you know. And I really think that's something that you get very strongly from analyzing engine games nowadays. You know, I mean, they really are amazing at making the very most of really getting optimal squares for the pieces, you know, in all sorts of positions. So yeah, I mean, I think that that Ali Reis is a very good example of somebody who's been, I think, very positively influenced by engines, you know, either directly working with them or by the, you know, by the incredible material that's now available because of them.
Yeah, you have some great examples of castling by hand, and the general treatment of the king in your book. So I can definitely see that. But I think that's going to be challenging for club players, because I think part of what they struggle with generally is like when to break the rules. And now this sense of harmony that you described, there's sort of an ineffability, I think, for anyone who's not, you know, not a grandmaster, let alone a super engine. But one lesson that, to me, I think that we can derive from watching the World Championship and from the engines is just, as you mentioned earlier, the sort of utter lack of regard for material. Like, you know, and any club player who's worried about sacrificing, like, you know, your move might be unsound, but you shouldn't worry too much that it's just going to be like effortlessly beaten back if you can put your opponent to the test.
Yeah. I mean, actually, there was a recent DeepMind paper. It was called Acquiring knowledge, or how AlphaZero acquires knowledge. I mean, that was the. We gave a talk recently at the London Chess Classic, and Natasha did three or four great slides on this new paper. And they try to understand, you know, how does AlphaZero gain knowledge? I mean, what is important? And one of the beautiful things that came out of it, and that Natasha highlighted, was that. You know, when AlphaZero starts off, it's virtually random, but it's only really when it gets a sense of what is material, how much are my pieces worth, that suddenly all the rest of its game fits into place. And then once all that's happened, once it's got that idea, this sort of value for its pieces, then actually the value of material drops. And it starts being able to sacrifice again. But, you know, so I think, you know, what you talk about, if you're talking about thinking, you know, talking about what do players need to learn, you know, how do they progress from beginner to strong player? You know, there are, you know, as always, there are these phases where I think, first of all, you need to get a good grip of how much my piece is worth. You know, why is it not good to swap off a rook for somebody's pawn, you know, or something like that? And I to be honest, I've been playing against my nephew, who's seven, and strangely keen on chess. But he's, you know, again, for him, you see that he's really struggling with that concept that, you know, he gets the pawn for a rook, and he says, I've got a pawn. I've got a guy, you know, you've got a guy, but I've got a guy. And and you see that, you know, that was what you sort of gathered from these AlphaZero graphs. But once, you know, once you it understood about material, you could see again a differentiation in all the themes it was suddenly able to discover. And then afterwards, the value of material dropped as it started to learn more and more that, hey, wait a minute, you know, this is not as rigid a scale. I can start giving up the exchange, start giving up pawns for mobility and other themes that are important. But that was really fascinating as well. But I think, you know, certainly where we are, you know, nowadays with what we can learn from engines, you know, yeah, the value of sacrificing pawns, especially exchanges, you know, for long-term compensation. I mean, that's an enormous part of the game, you know.
Yeah, and on the topic of the evolution of AlphaZero, Mark Jave, supporter of the podcast, actually wrote in, and he was curious specifically about the evolution of opening. So he was wondering, did AlphaZero start, like, did it trace the evolution of chess, where you start out with more of the romantic type openings, like the Evans and King's Gambit he mentioned, and then get more sound? Did it follow that path?
Yeah, that's a lovely question. As far as I can gather, no, not really. I mean, what really happened was that AlphaZero started off playing very randomly, and then seemed to get. It looks like, you know, it got a grasp of certain concepts and ways of thinking, and then afterwards it went pretty much to the main lines, you know. So you start seeing very quickly once it's got past a short initial burst of training, it starts going on to the Rilo pairs, you know, and then, you know, moves on from there. But, you know, mainline e4, E4, D4 openings. You know, it didn't really follow the, it doesn't have a romantic phase, you know, and stuff like that, as far as I can tell. You know, it just basically had a period of not playing very well, playing quite randomly, and then all of a sudden everything clicking into place, and then it just starts playing, you know, stronger and stronger, but in the classical way that it played towards the end, really.
No romance from those computers.
No romance, no.
I guess it's not too surprising. Well, Matthew, we have a ton of good listener questions that I want to get into, but first let's take a break and hear from our sponsors. What is new from Chessable, you ask? Well, friend of the pod FM Camille Plichta just dropped Lifetime Repertoire's Accelerated Dragon. I know a lot of Accelerated Dragon enthusiasts have been waiting for that, and I've heard rave reviews. I am Christoph Zalecki, aka Chess Explained, has a Keep It Simple Black repertoire coming soon. And of course, whether it be an opening course, a tactics course, or an endgame course on Chessable, you can utilize their proprietary space repetition technology to make sure you learn the lessons that are being imparted. So be sure to go to chessable.com and have a look at what's new. And we are back. So Matthew, as I said, we've got a long list of good questions for you. But one thing I wanted to hit before we get to them is one point that I found really interesting in Silicon Road to Chess Improvement. One of those nod your head as you read moments was where you mentioned a conversation you had with Grandmaster Jonathan Tisdall about the more pronounced evaluation values, where suddenly, where it used to be, it might be +1 in a position, but now it's +5, even though material might be even in a given position. That's been happening more and more with engines. And so what's your explanation for that?
Yeah, they're just getting better and better. That's the problem. I mean, it was very noticeable actually in game 11, you know, and I was watching Anish Giri's commentary, excellent actually, together with Judit Poldedar, and Magnus reached this rook ending and the engine was saying +6. You know, and Anish was saying, well, yeah, I'm sorry, it doesn't feel +6 to me. I mean, yeah. I think it's a rook and a pawn, right? And you know, the guy still got a rook on the board. So, that is one of the the difficulties. I mean, this is particularly, you know, what you've got to be a little bit careful about is that different engines have different scales of evaluation. So, you know, Stockfish is quite extreme from that point of view. Leela is much more restrained. You know, I mean, I think, you know, something like 0.7 for Leela would be +3, +4 for Stockfish. So, you know, I mean, that's slightly different, but certainly, you know, engines, the evaluations have become more and more extreme. But yeah, I mean, you look at the result of the games that they evaluate like that, and it's always correct. It's not like they're getting over optimistic and then scaling back. It's simply that they're seeing much, much earlier, when a position is just, you know, completely winning. And that makes it tricky for humans to calibrate themselves a little bit, because it really depends on the position, but obviously, you know, a +5 from an engine could be something quite horrifically scary, you know, that a human would find very, very difficult to replicate, you know, and even, you know, +5 for a rook ending, you know, when you're just one pawn up, you know, just feels incredible. But I mean, in general, those evaluations have to be trusted. But again, you know, just in terms of applying it to human play, I mean, you know, I think probably what we're being asked at the moment, it's the same thing that I mentioned for the World Championship second. You know, you do have to make some sort of translation for yourself all the time back into human play, you know, and some engines make it easier. I think, you know, Leela's evaluations are much closer to what I think, you know, to human evaluations, as we see them, and, you know, they're scaled differently. And also, you know, Leela's evaluation, it always takes into account the possibility that the opponent might make some errors and some blunders. So, you know, that's why it tends to scale stuff down a little bit. But I think you're always going to have to do some sort of translating back into human terms about what an engine is saying. But, you know, I think the evaluations in themselves are objectively absolutely correct. You know, +5, yeah, means it's going to be a win, against best play, and no arguments.
Yeah, I guess in a sense, the results are binary. Either it's a win or it's a draw. So if it knows it's a win, it's going to start to skew higher. And if it knows it's a draw, it's going to skew lower.
I mean, what was very interesting, and that's, again, coming back to the value of playing engine matches, was that, you know, this ending in game six, you know, on move 36 between Magnus and Jan, you know, if Jan had played bishop takes b4, you know, the engines were only at plus 1.5, plus 2 or something. You know, and it was sort of one of the Stockfish developers.
Minus, right?
Yeah, minus. Sorry, that's right. Yeah. And one of the Stockfish developers said, well, you know, that's quite incredible, really, that, you know, even at this late stage in the game, you know, lots of pieces exchanged. You know, for the engines, it's not like a clear win. I mean, it's clearly much better for black, but they're not yet sure whether that's going to convert to a clear win or not. And and again, you know, that's the value of playing out engine games. You know, you put the engine on at move 36, it'll tell you minus 2, but is that going to be a win or not? You're not sure. You let them play the game, you know, searching ever deeper as they get further and further into the position, and you get a much better idea of whether it was actually a win or not, you know. So I thought, you know, that was, again, a very interesting demonstration of the power of engine games, you know, from that point of view.
Yeah, and we'll have more on that on some of these listener questions. So let's dig into them. The first one is from Evan Rosenberg, who asks, he says, when Kasparov lost to Deep Blue, the chess world collectively shook for fear that machines had permanently surpassed the capabilities of the human mind. And I distinctly remember Kasparov's suspicions after game two, when he appeared convinced that there was some human interference because no machine could possibly demonstrate such finesse. Fast forward to today, and any chess enthusiast can download the Stockfish app at no cost, with instant access to a super powerful engine to use casually or as seriously as one desires. Can you specify at what point did chess machines become less imposing and threatening and more helpful and awe-inspiring? And do you see a return to the idea that humans are at risk of, for lack of a better term, chess extinction?
Yeah, I mean, just taking the last question first. I mean, chess extinction, I think if it was going to happen, it would already have happened. You know, I mean, I retired from professional chess in 1999. And I mean, there were many reasons for it. But, you know, one of the reasons that I had was that, you know, I really thought that, you know, 4 or 5 years, you know, engines are, you know, they're are going to be just be so much stronger than humans that nobody's going to be interested in watching humans play. I mean, people are just going to have the engines there and just be able to laugh at grandmasters, you know, whilst they play. But actually, it's turned out, you know, completely differently. And, you know, the beautiful thing about it is that obviously people do get a lot of pleasure from watching chess, from watching the best human players play. But one of the big impediments was that they didn't have a clue what was going on. And, you know, engines have filled in that gap. And, you know, you still need the human commentary, like, you know, Anish and Judith and Fabiano and, you know, and all these great players. You still need that to give, you know, the real insight. But in terms of knowing basically the evaluation of the position and what's going on and a few little lines, you know, engines have really helped with that. So I don't think we're ever going to go to chess extinction. I mean, you know, just I think, you know, this way of playing and top level chess is going to carry on for you know, for a very, very long time. And I mean, when did engines get less scary? I guess simply when they landed on your desktop and you were able to do really cool things with them, you know, and then suddenly people thought, you know, very human, of course, but oh God, I can get an advantage over someone else if I only know how to use this tool properly. And you know, it's you know, I you know, but it was quite funny. I mean, when Natasha and I did Chess for Life, you know, we interviewed Pia Kramling, you know, absolutely lovely lady, and you know, very, very strong player. But she said that in the pre-computer age, she worked a lot with her husband, Juan Bellon, you know, who was a incredibly creative player, very strong in openings, and she felt that she had a big advantage, you know, because they were working together and finding these incredible ideas. And then the computer came along and it destroyed, you know, all that advantage. And neither of them were computer literate. So it was a huge panic for them. And then, you know, eventually they managed to, you know, to get to grips with it you know, and adjust to the modern age. But Judith says something very similar, that she didn't particularly want to work with engines, but she realized that you had to do it because it gave, you know, such a massive advantage and such a massive disadvantage if you didn't. So, I think, you know, as soon as they became available on your local PC and useful, that you know, players change their attitude to them really. And I think, you know, for modern players, it would be unthinkable not to have an engine. I remember I talked to Robin van Kampen, a young Dutch GM at a 4NCL one time, and you know, talking about the old days and the old guys. It was then that, to my shock, that I realized that he considered me as an old guy, you know, and one of the dinosaurs. But anyway, that's something else. But you know, trying to explain to him that, yeah, you know, Robin, you know, I could spend 2 weeks analyzing, you know, Bishop G5 Nidorf poison pawn, and after 2 weeks I wouldn't really be sure, you know, what the evaluation was. I just got a bit further, you know, and then somewhere later, maybe in the next month, I'd try and spend another 2 weeks, you know, to get further. And he's looking at me like, you know, are you what's the fun in that, you know what? And it, you know, it's really a way of working that people, that, you know, modern players probably can't even imagine at all nowadays. So, you know, I think for them, you know, you take away their engine, that would be, you know, like an ultimate crime somehow, you know, whereas you know, players of my generation, we still remember the good old days. You know, it's with the good and the bad. You know, it's
During one of the broadcasts on Ishgiri, speaking of fear of the engines, he was talking about Magnus, and he said that basically that Magnus fears no human, and he fears no human move, but what he does fear is engine prep. So. And I think that might get to the recent talk about potentially retiring. I do think that even though he came up with these creative ideas, he and his team, and, you know, showed this lack of materialism that the engines events, as we've discussed. But I do think that the sort of arms race of like dodging these landmines by the engine might contribute to his lack of enthusiasm for the World Championship in particular. As a quick digression, Matthew, what did you think about this? This news from Magnus that he may or may not defend his title.
I mean, I've never had such a huge run of continued success, so it's a bit hard to sort of, you know, think yourself into that thing, and then it's equally hard to think, you know, why would it be nice to give that up? You know, that's I find that very hard. But I mean, you know, at times, you know, Magnus has seemed a little bored about things, not really about chess, but more about the way of the professional chess player nowadays, you know, with especially that, you know, the ethos of heavy preparation and all that thing. So, you know, in some ways it's not a complete surprise, you know, to hear him saying this. You know, the nice thing is that, you know, press statements are not given under oath, so we can allow him to come back from that if he ever wants to. But my feeling about it is that he's definitely thinking about it. Whether it's something that he goes through, or whether it's something that, you know, in a year and a half time, that, you know, he has a different feeling about it, you know, who knows? But the one thing that I do wonder is, you know, whether you know, if he gave up the World Championship, whether he'd still be able to to carry on playing. This is kind of different, but somehow it sort of gets to what I mean is that, you know, when I stopped playing as a professional, I carried on playing Bundesliga for about a year and a half, and, you know, my initial naive thought was that take away the need to play professionally, and I'm just going to be able to enjoy myself, I'm going to be able to play, you know, creatively, try, you know, crazy stuff and all that, you know. It could actually, taking something away could actually add something to my game. But, you know, your game, the way that you've built up your game all through your career, it's really an edifice, you know, and every single thing that you've done is a component of it and contributes to its strength, you know, and also some of its weaknesses as well. But take something away from that, and suddenly, you know, you're not quite the same player. And I had that experience, first of all, when I decided that I was going to retire from professional chess. When my play, you know, that was late 98, I decided to do that. And, well, just look at my games from late 98 to 99 when I finally retired. And you're going to, you see, you know, an awful lot more blunders, an awful decrease in quality and intensity. And then again, you know, when I decided I'm not professional, going to play for some fun, again, you saw a decrease in quality as well. So I don't know, you know, just from my point of view, I don't know whether you could take away like a cornerstone of his personality, which is being world champion, and then hope to still play at the same fantastic level. You know, I certainly know that if anyone's got a chance to do it, then he could do it much better than I ever could. But I do wonder, you know, I mean, because I really feel that being world champion is kind of part of Magnus's competitive ability. I mean, I'd find it really weird to see Magnus Carlsen playing and him not being world champion. You know, I mean, that would be... that would be something quite weird. So I don't know, but I can, you know, I think he was, you know, he was completely honest when he said about it. And I think that these probably are the thoughts that only somebody who's been at the top for that long, you know, could really have. You know, I think the rest of us who just looked from the foothills, we probably just have to accept it and understand it. And, you know, just hope that that's not the case, that he'll change his mind.
Yeah, and I should have specified for anyone who didn't hear what Magnus had said. He said he is feeling less motivated for every world championship, and he thinks that if Ali Reza Firouzja were to emerge from the candidates, he would be up for a world championship match against him, but suggested that if anyone else wins, he could potentially vacate the throne, but he said not retire from chess. And he actually, speaking to the issue of motivation, mentioned the possibility of chasing the 2900 ELO reading, which would be crazy. But yeah, I agree with what you said, Matthew. I saw a lot of parsing of motivations online, and I do think he was speaking from the heart. So all we can do is hope that he changes his mind or that Ali Reza wins the candidates. One or the other. Okay, well, we're going to take one more break, Matthew, and then we've got a bunch of listener questions to get back to. Good news, listeners. According to aimchess.com, I'm now only behind on the clock 75% of the time in my blitz games. That's actually huge progress for me. I'm going to keep working to bring it up, and I recommend you use aimchess.com to address whatever weaknesses you may have in your game, whether it be playing with the white or black pieces, a particular opening, or a particular phase of the game. They give tailored lessons for whatever their algorithm detects, and of course, their algorithm scrapes the games from the major chess playing sites themselves in order to tell you what you need. If you decide to subscribe to aimchess.com after checking it out, be sure to use the promo code perpetual30. Details are in the show notes. Check out aimchess.com. And we are back, and we're going to dive right into some more listener engine related questions. This one is from Igor Feinstein, and Igor writes to say, if chess is fundamentally a draw and today's engines are rated well over 3000, what explains chess engines still regularly beating each other? Does that suggest that engines still have flaws, or that they trip up in some quirky situations or endgame situations or other phases of the game?
Yeah, I mean, I think the key point about it is that, you know, the starting position of chess is basically a draw. I mean, but lots and lots of chess positions aren't draws. And lots of positions are unfathomable, still, you know, not calculable by engines. Complex, can go many different ways. Different engines with different approaches will find different moves in them. So, you know, I mean, that's where the richness comes. And that's why, you know, at the TCC, we do, we have this super final every season, you know, the big final event where two engines fight out a 100-game match, 50 different openings. But, you know, I did the openings together with another nice guy called Jeroen Noman. Half of the openings for that match, and there the struggle is to find, you know, complicated openings that will challenge the engines and that will ask them to negotiate unusual problems. So it's I mean, they are not perfect, absolutely not. They have their flaws as well, which you can, you know, find out in unusual situations. And so much of chess is not a draw, but yeah, just the starting position is really too balanced. And yeah, you let the engines play out from the starting position nowadays, you'll get 100 draws. You know, it's even Fischer Random is kind of in danger of that as well. So, you know, the TCC, again, they're running a Fischer Random competition now, which is always great fun. But I think for the final, they're going to have a small book to try and get some slightly more unbalanced Fischer Random positions, you know. So, just in general, you know, still lots and lots of middle game positions that have plenty of scope for play, and still for a long while yet. I think, you know, I think we're still a very long way away from solving chess with engines.
That's good to hear. And on a separate But I guess related note, we have a question from Chris Lott, Patreon supporter of the podcast. And Chris asks, he says, given the advances in the last few years with AlphaZero and Leela and various combos with traditional engines, will the standard advice not to play computers to improve one's game against other humans change? Or maybe another way to phrase the question, will mainstream software ever really play like a human?
Yeah, there's interesting questions. I mean, first of all, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I believe that that you should play against engines in order to improve your game. I mean, that's the kind of the more or less the way I've been working probably for about, 6 or 7 years, actually, and certainly since AlphaZero and Game Changer. So, yeah, definitely believe there are so many useful ways to use your engines to improve your game. And then in terms of, engines becoming human-like, it's sort of two ways, really. I mean, I think we should maybe become a bit more engine-like as well, and try and get the there's big parts of engine play that I think are really accessible to humans that we should try and emulate. In particular, the quality of your evaluation. But there are also a lot of tries to make engines that play more like humans. I think Maya on you can play against
Maya bot on Nitro. Shout out to Maya there.
It's and also I was talking with one of the another Leela developer who's again they're all really young, really friendly guys, who just always happy to spend a lot of time explaining stuff to you. But he was suggesting some parameters. Could you try these and see how does that affect its play? Does it play more more human-like, more towards the level that you'd that could be just a direct training partner? So I'm going to try and give those sort of things a go. I mean, at the end of the day, it's all software, so infinitely tunable and very, very powerful. So it wouldn't amaze me, to be honest, if we could come up with an engine that plays much more like a strong human player. What's nice about Leela in particular is that, even just restricting its search depth, it has this lovely positional style. So, it plays very much like a very good positional player. And then just restricting its search depth, you just sort of, if you just allow it to search no moves whatsoever, it'll make a few one-move blunders in the middle of some lovely positional play. You let it search just a little bit more, it'll make fewer blunders, but won't find the really complicated tactical line. So even that is a beautiful, I find it a very nice way to play against a weaker engine that's not just making stupid catastrophic blunders just on every 10 moves just to keep the rating lower, but it's kind of a very organic way of playing, but just with slightly less fantastic calculation abilities. I mean, I find that a very pleasurable way to play. And, in the Silicon Road, I give a number of examples from that match, and it was fantastic fun. I mean, it was really, I had a great time playing against Leela like that. So, yeah, I mean, I definitely think it's going to, people, are working on this and it's going to happen. But I think, probably we should be, we should be trying to become a bit more machine-like in our evaluation. Yeah. But, I mean, one thing that sort of, it was kind of something that got me thinking about that too, was that, that Magnus played about 450 games on Light Chess before the World Championship match, bullet and blitz games.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, okay, let's try and mine that for clues. So I just took the database of his games. Thank you, Light Chess. I mean, incredible resource. And just blunder checked it with my engine. So just looking for, bad blunders. And I have to say that, you look at Magnus, at the quality of Magnus's play, the number of terrible blunders that he makes at that speed, and it's so small, absolutely unbelievable. And, the most blunders that were found were in the conversion phase where the engine said, oh, well, you could have had plus 15 and now you're only plus 13, but in terms of actual play, the blunders were small, which I think, shows that Magnus's intuition really is at that machine level. It's really, on virtually no thinking whatsoever. He's maybe playing 2550, 2600, maybe higher. And I think that is what humans should try to emulate. And if I look at my own strength at that speed, I'm maybe, 2100 or something like that, and I think that, again, if I had my time again, if I'd realized this earlier, I would have been, working, putting a huge amount of my chess work, not on improving all the other areas of my game, but really working on improving the evaluation, because I think that's the basis of so much of your of your chest strength. You know, it's and it, you know, also made me, you know, I thought of that as well, because, you know, if you're looking at you know, thinking about what happened in the match between Magnus and Jan as well, you know, that Jan after the game six, he really, you know, he sort of fell away, and but he was saying that he, you know, he made blunders in games 8, 9, and 11 that he just hadn't he couldn't explain, right? You know, I mean, he didn't understand why he'd made those blunders, and you know, I really think it was a case of probably that game six affected Jan even more than he'd realised, you know. Yeah. And I've had this experience as a professional that you have a bad loss, and then, you know, somehow you think, oh my goodness, you know, the next day I actually managed to sleep okay-ish. You know, I don't feel too bad. I do my morning routine, tactics, puzzles, studies. I'm okay. I'm fine. I've got my preparation. Okay, let's go to the game. And then the most appalling thing that happens to you is that you turn up to the game and you feel absolutely nothing. It's as if your heart has been broken and that the whole world around you looks grey and there's no differentiation between any of the moves. You can't tell whether moves are good or bad. And, you know, when you analyze chess, it's not linear. I mean, you're looking at stuff and there's little sparks and ideas flying. Oh, don't play knight b5, bishop b3, loses a piece, all those sort of things, you know. And in that state, you don't feel any of that at all. And then you realize, you know, how much of your blunder checking and how much of your tactical awareness is purely intuitive. It's purely to do with those emotions and those feelings and those sparks of life that you have, you know, when you're functioning normally. And when you lose a bad game like that, you know, it takes that away. And then that's the moment that you can blunder. And that's really what happened to me in a couple of tournaments in 99, when I was, you know, thinking of retiring from chess. You know, really that feeling, that terrible feeling of feeling nothing, of knowing how important it is with your head, but your heart just doesn't react somehow, you know. And and I felt somehow that maybe that was what, you know, happened with Jan, that you know, he did his, you know, he felt, okay, I think I've recovered from that shock, but somehow, you know, it had affected him even more than he thought. And you know, again, that's getting back to, you know, to that evaluation being such a big part of your chess strength, that, you know, intuitive, instinctive stuff that you don't even think about, but that protects you against tactics and protects you against stupid mistakes, and you know, and a loss can really affect that.
Yeah, Vasilin Topalov did an interview with Chess24, a brief interview, and he highlighted similar points about Magnus. His stamina, he mentioned his ability to just play error-free for 6 to 7 hours. So
yeah,
again, that gets to what you're saying about those Lee Chess sessions that everyone made fun of. But
I mean, really, I'd recommend anyone to look at it. I mean, it really is amazing. The other funny thing about it, though, because when I talked about it with Gary, and Gary said, well, tell me then what he was playing. And, well, you did notice he'd been playing d4, knight f3, g3 a lot, you know. And
interesting.
And then it came up, you know, it came up in game six, you know. And it was, I don't know. I mean, you know, I mean, he plays a lot of different things on Lee Chess. But it was somehow quite striking, you know, to see that. But I'd really recommend, you know, anyone, you know, just play through those games and be amazed, because it was a really amazing standard of instant playing without any sort of thinking, you know.
By the way, how did the relationship, the opportunity to do the videos with Garry Kasparov for Kasparov Chess, how did that come about, Matthew? They were so fun to watch.
Oh, fantastic. Thanks very much. Yeah, it came about just quite late, actually. And I just got asked, you know, I don't know whether, you know, maybe Gary, you know, Gary's just nonstop busy. So I don't know whether suddenly, you know, some sort of gap in his diary came out and he suddenly thought, yeah, okay, we're going to do that. But I got asked quite late. And funnily enough, through very good fortune, I've been planning out my Christmas holidays together with my manager. And we sort of said, well, you know, one of us has got to be present, you know, there's got to be one of us present, you know, throughout the period. And he's got kids. And he said, okay, well, I really do want to take Christmas off. And then I thought, well, you know, COVID lockdown, what am I going to do? You know, just stay at home. But I could also just take my holiday now, my Christmas holiday now, and watch the World Championship, you know. Okay. You know, so we just agreed that quite late. And then virtually, you know, literally the next day, got called and said, you know, would you fancy doing this with Gary? You know, and I mean, it just made it for me, you know, just real great thing. You know, I was spending all my time with my engines, you know, doing all sorts of lovely stuff, analyzing the World Championship. And then in the evening, you get, just half an hour to discuss it with Gary afterwards. You know, this incredible, obviously, you know, a huge, just a towering figure for me because, he was always there when I was a professional chess player. He was the standard that you aspired to. And, still, obviously, you know, incredibly strong player and, you know, huge World Championship experience, you know, just to talk about, you know, what's going on in a match. So that was incredible, and I enjoyed it very much. I thought the talks went well. I mean, I thought Gary really had a lot to say about all the match and the games as well. So I enjoyed it an awful lot.
Yeah, and the psychological factors, of course. And any listeners who haven't seen those video recaps, even knowing the outcome, it's still worth watching. Now, Matthew, are there any, obviously, I watched them and learned a lot from them, but is there any particular insight from these weeks of recording? Any, like, sort of big picture takeaway from talking to Kasparov or, like, particular statement he made that really resonated with you?
Well, I mean, yeah. I think, what we said, you know, before the match was that, the big question in the match was going to be, we were sure that Magnus was always going to come back from a horrific event in the, during the World Championship. You know, the big question was whether Young could do that, you know, and as it turned out, not the only commentators to say that, I hasten to add, but that was, you know, and that was somehow the big thing that, that came out of the match, of course. And I think, probably the one thing that you can't train, really, you know, I don't think you can train to come back from that sort of blow in this sort of situation. It's going to be, it's partly pot luck and it's partly, you know, down to the player himself. What I also found quite interesting was, I asked Gary some questions about, you know, well, how did you do things? You know, the last couple of days before an event, you know, would you take a rest? Would you take a break? You know, keep your mind fresh. And Gary, you know, he obviously found this a very strange question. He, you know, looked and said, no. You know, once I started the event, I went. You know, it was just chess, walking, sleeping, chess. And you know, what you really felt from that was, and made me think because Jan talked about how he'd. He'd asked for advice from many different players about the match, but that he'd realised that a match was unique. And you realise also that players are unique, because I think for Gary, you know, I've got this incredible impression that for him, it was all about once the match came within sight, he would give it everything. And if it didn't go well, he would simply pour more of that, you know, astonishing energy that he's got into grabbing it by the scruff of the neck and making it go right, you know, but that's, again, that's something that, you know, that Gary could do. And that was his innate, huge personal strength, I think, you know, and then you notice that, yeah, you know, other players have to do it in a different way. And I think for every player, a World Championship is a unique experience, and they have to approach it in their unique way. And but that really struck me, you know, just trying to find out from Gary, you know, what do you do to relax? What did you do? If you had a loss, even, but you know, the answer kind of was always the same. It's simply, you know, energy. Get back to it. You know, put more in. You know, I guess what you also had in those days, though, that's, you know, not the case now. Of course, Gary always had a big preparation advantage. You know, I mean, he was right up there with computer preparation, with all, you know, the way that he organized his training and everything. And I think, you know, that was always, you always had the, when you face Gary, you always had an enormous amount of opening minefields to avoid. Whereas, of course, you know, here in this match, you know, you just saw parity in the openings. Essentially, all that work by all the seconds beforehand was to make sure that nothing bad happened.
Right.
And for the rest, you were going for small advantages, but there was never the real likelihood of a huge bombshell hitting you, you know. Whereas, you know, obviously in Gary's time with, you know, you think of the match against Vichy in 95, you know, this where Vichy got hit by, in this open Lopez with this enormous novelty. You know, I mean, that's kind of unthinkable nowadays, really, you know. What Gary did afterwards, switching, you know, with his opponent a bit woozy, switching to the dragon, that could definitely happen. That was really modern world championship approach. You know, it was probably the world's most unpleasant thing that could have happened to Vichy. You know, that was superb psychology and match insight and all that that you could imagine in a match nowadays. But that you know, the open Lopez novelty, yeah, you'd be very surprised if that happened.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, lots to learn from Gary, but how to relax during a match, probably not at the top of the
not
list.
Not at all, no.
So we've still got a handful of questions I'd like to power through, Matthew, if you're okay. Great. So let's bring it back to engines just for a minute, and then I want to talk more about your competitive career, which I know you say you're retired, but you still managed to play, at least pre-COVID. So this one is from Ian Mason. Thank you for supporting the pod, Ian. And Ian asks, he says, do you think that correspondence chess has a future, given that 90% of the games at the top level are draws where using engines is permitted?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, we've got quite a few correspondence players in the TCC chat, and they're always complaining about the number of draws and how difficult it is. But I mean, what they were experimenting with for a correspondence tournament, I think it's happening at the moment, is starting just like the TCC from complicated openings. So, you know, starting 8 or 9 moves in, and you know, just having a position that that is unbalanced favors one side, and then, well, you know, you're going to have to show your skills to hold it. And I think that, to be honest, I think that's the future of correspondence chess, because I mean, it is just like engine chess. I mean, it's just you know, you can't you need some something extra, you know, in order to unbalance the game, in order to get wins. But if you don't have that, then yeah, I would think that correspondence chess would kind of lose its interest, you know, beyond you know, research into openings and anything like that. But in terms of competitive interest, it will get lost. So yeah, I mean, this approach of starting correspondence players off from unbalanced openings and seeing what they can do, I think that's a pretty interesting idea.
Yeah, that makes sense. That would help. And it seems like engines, I mean, there does seem to have been a bit of a leap, as you've mentioned, in the past few years in their strength. But overall, over the past, say, 20 years, it seems like they average maybe 50 points of ELO a year in gain. Do you see that continuing? Are they just going to keep getting better and better?
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? I mean, you know, just as a practical chess player, and I think Dubov said this in an interview, you know, you have the feeling, to be honest, that they've increased in strength ginormously the past 3 years. But yeah, one of the computer programmers, a very, very bright guy, Giancarlo Pascuto, he said that that actually, if you look at it objectively, you know, the game's been pretty steady. You know, I mean, the engines just kept on improving. I think it's just the, you know, the style and the things that they can do, and the way that we feel they've outstripped us in areas that we were always stronger in. I think that's why, you know, as a practical chess player, it feels huge. Yeah, I mean, you would have thought that at some stage, you know, you would have a limit to how strong they can get, but they really are improving all the time. I mean, partly due to the just amazing number of people in the open source community who keep on working at it. I mean, you know, the Leela guys, it's just a, you know, just, it's just a bunch of kids, you'd call them. They're, you know, right, less than half my age, most of them, you know. And and one of the guys was saying, yeah, no, I'm one of the old guys. I said, you know, how old are you? He said 25. You know, it's just you know, amazing. Wow. So, but I mean, so, and you know, the Stockfish guys as well, there's a, you know, a huge community. I mean, one of my videos actually on my Silicon Road site, I shared the Stockfish testing site, where you can see, you know, day on day, all the tests that are being run on all the patches, and it's the most impressive software development factory I've ever seen, you know, just from an IT point of view. So yeah, there's lots of people working in their free time, in their spare time, just, you know, making this stuff stronger and stronger. And yeah, really, I mean, it does get stronger and stronger. So I think we're just going to keep on seeing improvements, you know, just, you know, and also, you know, it's because especially the two main engines, Leela and Stockfish, are just approaching things from completely different angles. So Stockfish always typically had an absolutely godlike search, so calculation, but its evaluation was less strong. But they've added, you know, some neural net technology, NNUE, to their engine, and that net is getting bigger and bigger, and the evaluation is getting better and better. So they're approaching it from that angle with a godlike search and a stronger and stronger evaluation. And then Leela had the amazing, sophisticated evaluation, but its search was somewhat weaker. So, you know, and they're approaching it, you know, somewhat from that angle. So they're trying to make their evaluation better and better, but also to improve their search as well. And, well, yeah, I mean, the two engines, they just, you know, they just sort of keep on getting better and better from different angles. So, you know, I think it's going to, progress is going to carry on for, yeah, for a long time, I think, still. You don't get the feeling talking to the developers that they're, you know, that they're running out of ideas or running out of things to try to make their engines better. I mean, to be honest, the opposite. I think they're coming up with, you know, with more and more stuff. I mean, there's new neural net technology, what's it, attention networks, and they were looking at that now all of a sudden for Leela. What could we do? Would that, you know, would that work? Could we implement that? And, you know, on the Leela side, of course, you know, it's kind of, for them, it's kind of, you know, half a chess project and also half research into neural nets, into technology that could be applied to, you know, so many other things as well. So, yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. It's, you know, really fascinating subject. And I get, you know, I'm an IT guy, of course. So, you know, obviously I'll always have some extra enthusiasm for, you know, for the IT part of chess nowadays, but still, you know, it's incredibly, you know, exciting and interesting area of chess, I think, you know, and with a lot, you know, a lot of implications for the real world as well, you know. So and it's always interesting, you know, that's what we always what we found about you know, DeepMind. I mean, DeepMind bring out so many new technologies, so many amazing discoveries. But, you know, if you can view it through the prism of what you understand about AlphaZero and as a chess engine, it suddenly makes so much more sense, you know, rather than just trying to get directly into complicated science. You know, it's it's very exciting period for chess engines and for IT in general in the world.
Huh. Amazing to hear that they can just keep getting stronger and stronger. But yeah, I mean, it certainly doesn't seem like they're letting up. And I trust what you and the experts have told you. One more engine question, which I think is important because this has come up on the podcast before. It's a common issue. This is a question from Alex Friedman. Alex says, in winning positions, engines are usually going into complications without fear, when the more human way to win would be to simplify and not allow counterplay. This makes it difficult to learn how to win one games using engine analysis. Are there engines that are more instructive in this sense?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good point. I mean, they can just certainly from winning positions, you know, engines can see, well, pretty much the end often. So, yeah, I mean, that's a bit of a tough one. I mean, to be honest, what I found, it's not quite the same, but what I found to be a great training, and again, I give an example of that in the Silicon Road, it's taking won positions, you know, clearly won positions for you that you've maybe won in a game that you played, and then just try and beat Stockfish from there. And, you know, that gives such an amazing insight into the defensive possibilities of positions that you consider are just, you know, clearly lost, hopeless. I mean, I gave an example in the Silicon Road. It was a game, it was a pairs game that I played with Terry Chapman against Chris Gant and Nick Peart. And we reached this ending, you know, Black's just, I considered it to be trivially winning, you know, and we won it, you know, very smoothly in the game. Then you put it against Stockfish and I made 1.5 out of 3, you know, I lost one of them as Black and I drew one and then, you know, I won one as well. And, you know, the resources and the coordination of the pieces, just, it was a rook and bishop versus rook and knight ending that that Stockfish achieved, you know, with the king, bishop, bishop and rook and its pawns, was just incredible, you know. And and that was a real eye-opener again, you know, for me about you know, the possibilities that you have in position. So yeah, now I understand the point and I think it's true. You know, engines can calculate too well. One nice thing, you know, again, is that you can try is running Leela on very low calculation, because then it won't be able to calculate its way to the end, but it will just try and feel its way positionally to a winning advantage. And that can be a very nice way to practice that winning one games. But I really think that this training of trying to win your own one games against Stockfish, you know, and seeing what it can do to you and how it can resist, that's, you know, one of the most, that's a real eye opener. You know, I think it'll really give you a lot more faith in the defensive possibilities after that.
Yeah, I definitely agree. It's whenever I try these like drill exercises, winning like even against the like web-based bots that are not like as strong, it's depressing.
It's depressing, so. But it's also, you know, it's also, you know, challenging. I mean, you know, if you get past that, if you can understand, you know, what's going wrong in your thinking process and why you're not actually able to do that, you know, then, you know, it's a big advantage. And, you know, again, you could never get a human coach to do that against you. You'd never get anyone with the patience. Oh, okay, I'll try again then, you know. It's, but funnily enough, you know, I mean, this was when I studied with Mark Turetsky for a couple of years in 94, life-changing experience for me. But he, you know, he did a lot of that. I mean, he gave you these very complicated studies, which he'd analyzed to, you know, enormously. And then he made you play them out. You know, you didn't know when the solution would end or whatever. You just had to play them out and he would take the other side. And again, you know, one of the most useful and challenging ways of training that I've done. And yeah, with the engines, you can replicate that, you know, perfectly. So it's a really, really valuable way of training.
Yeah. And you can hear more on Matthew's experiences working with, I am Mark Dvoretsky, legendary trainer in our first interview. I was definitely keen to ask you about that the first time around. And the last major topic I wanted to talk about, Matthew, of course, you've alluded several times to being retired, but you do play league games and you've maintained your rating, which is, you know, increasingly rare. I was checking before our interview and there's currently only 5 people over the age of 40 in the top 50. Topalov, Adams, Anand, yourself, and GM Zoltan Almasi. So it's a rare feat. And I think a lot of our listeners, you know, we're not trying to play, well, we would love to, but we're not realistically expecting to play at the elite level, but we are hoping to at least maintain our form or improve. So Tyron Ross Price had written in and asked for any advice you could share in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's you know, several things. I mean, first of all, you've got to work out for yourself, first of all, what makes you enjoy over the ball play, you know, when you actually play. I mean, and that is the very most important thing that you've got to guarantee. So if, and it varies from player to player, you know, so for some players, the whole process of preparing for a game, building up to it, making a big event of it, that's absolutely part and parcel of the experience. I mean, Terry Chapman, who we interviewed in Chess for Life, for him, that was a big thing, you know, that whole over the ball preparation. That's how he lived for his games. For other people, just, you know, being relaxed and turning up to the board and being in a nice, calm frame of mind, that's what they want. But I mean, that is the basis. I mean, you have to understand what works for you best and what will lead to the greatest enjoyment for playing. Because if you're amateur, that's, you know, that's part and parcel of it. You know, it's even the same for me, even if my definition of enjoyment is somewhat more lunatic on the lunatic fringe than most people. But I mean, you know, there are certain types of work that I, you know, really cut out just because I decided that it wasn't, you know, I was just trying to be too professional and I wanted to be, you know, to get the enjoyment there for first and foremost. I mean, the other thing,
what did you cut out?
I actually cut out this enormous amounts of sifting through engine analysis that I used to do. You know, I used to run engines for 6 hours, multiple engines for 6 hours on various positions in my openings, and then sift through all the analysis and, you know, find the best moves from all that, put it all together. You know, it took me hours and hours and hours. And I eventually decided that I found that quite distressing work. You know, it was, when I discovered, you know, when I really sort of got into the idea that I could run engine games, you know, just run massive engine games, get all these amazing, incredible fights and all that, and pick out 10 games from that total of games, and that would be my inspiration for playing my openings. You know, that was a lifesaver, I have to say. You know, it was that was really something that gave me enormous pleasure preparing for my openings without the enormous mental drain that of, you know, sifting through mathematically move by move, you know, just you know, trying to work out what the engines felt was 0.18 rather than 0.17. you know, I mean, that was a bad use of engines, you know, though instructive in its own way. But that, you know, I cut that out and tried to move to something that would give me, you know, pleasure and also be, you know, more useful. And I think, you know, all this running of engine games was a great switch. But I mean, the other thing I think as well is that, you know, as an amateur, what I noticed was that, you know, it's very easy to lose track of your chess because you're, you know, you've got your job, you've got family, you've got all sorts of stuff. And, you know, before you know it, you spent a week and you haven't looked at chess at all. So one of the key things to do, you know, that I had for myself was 15 minutes of chess a day, every single day. It doesn't really matter what it is. It could just be solving some tactical puzzles or playing through a nice game. But you've got to keep those channels active because before you know it, a week's gone past. And that for an amateur player, that's like being away from the board for a month. You know, it's just like you can't remember stuff anymore. So so that's very important. And then if you're looking at, you know, if I wanted to do some regular work, what should I do? I'd say tactics puzzles, evocative games that inspire you. And some end games, maybe some end game studies, you know, and that should really be the basis of your regular work, you know, tactics, because missing tactics, that's the biggest cause of frustration during a game. You know, if you spend 10 minutes looking at a move and then you realize at the end, oh my goodness, I'm dropping a piece that way. You know, spotting those quickly, that's really, really important. Evocative games that inspire you, that will stick in your memory and that will come easily to your mind when you're actually playing a game, when you need a parallel or something like that. I mean, it's why I love engine games, because I find so many of them so unbelievably fantastic, you know, and you see a theme in them, and there's some lovely tactics as well, and you think, wow, I can remember that. I'll remember that. That will come into my head, you know, when I play. And then end games, just because it teaches you so much about coordination of material, of limited material. It really teaches you about the power of individual pieces, about how to get the most out of them. And, you know, my belief is that is at the basis of why engines and why they're so strong and how they evaluate. They just understand how to get the most out of their pieces. And of course, studies are the ultimate, you know, the ultimate way to get to really understand that and get the most out of that. So, I mean, that I would say would be your basic training. So, you know, two things that require a little bit of work for you, and one piece of work that just requires ooh and ah and just being open and, you know, and enjoying it. And then from time to time, you can't get away from it, but, you know, it should be more just maybe a concentrated piece of work that you maybe do one weekend when, who knows, you know, your wife and kids have gone to visit the family or something. You work on openings, you know, and you just work through and you have a look at, you know, what your openings, what the current state of your openings are, whether there have been any recent games, get some fresh ideas maybe from playing through recent games, you know. But but that's more, I see that more as a, you know, a periodic chunk of work that you do rather than every day, you know, going through them. I'd say that, you know, in general, the working on your game and then just working on your opening in just at one period of time, concentrated, that's more useful. Because, you know, opening work, I tend to find if I do it in chunks, you know, a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit there, I just tend to lose track of it completely. And by the end, I can't remember anymore what I've been doing. Openings, it's kind of logic, right? I mean, it all fits together and it's all very consequent. You know, if he does that, I do that. If he does that, I do that. When he does that, I do this. You've got to do that sort of work in concentrated fashion, I think. I don't think you can do it, you know, just a little bit here, a little bit there. I don't think that works at all. Not for me anyway. Whereas the other sort of work that I mentioned, you can really do little bits of it and it just builds up very nicely. You know, it really builds up to give you extra strength. So that's what I would recommend, you know. And but, you know, the most important basis being really that you've got to make sure you understand what makes you enjoy playing and go for that. And also you've got to make sure that every single day you do a little bit of chess just to make sure that your brain keeps active and keeps, and that little space in your brain that's devoted to chess, that stays there and doesn't get pushed out by, you know, arguments at work having to repair a leaky tap or something like that. You know, you've got to look after that little spot in your brain for chess.
Excellent. Yeah. Fantastic advice. And Matthew, as we record this on Friday, what's today's date? December 17th or something like that. there's no quit in COVID. The Omicron is wreaking havoc, I know, in so many places.
Yeah.
So are you going to manage to, do you have plans of competing over the board again, if and when this ever ends?
Yeah, no, I do want to compete again, actually. I mean, what I've found is that every time I compete, I learn an awful lot. You know, I mean, the lessons that you get in over the board play, you know, can't be compared to what you do in analysis. And for me, actually, you know, the whole process of preparing for a game, I find it incredibly enriching process. So I definitely do want to play. The only thing is that, you know, I'm quite close to my parents and helping to look after them and support them during the lockdown. Yeah, I'm a little bit nervous about doing too much, you know, and exposing myself too much, and then bringing COVID over to them, really. So, you know, that's kind of what's holding me back at the moment. I've done some little things, you know, gave a lecture in a London Classic recently, you know, and done some small things, but at the moment I don't really want to get into to anything like that. I mean, just hoping, like all the rest of us, that, you know, there is, you know, some end to this, and that we're going to be able to reach a state where, you know, even if it's not gone, that at least the risks are not too terrible, even if you would catch COVID, you know. But at the moment, you're sort of very nervous about that. Somebody like Nigel, who I spoke to at London Classic, a couple of Saturdays ago, and you see that he's in hospital with oxygen and all that. You know, it's still a really scary thing still, you know. So again, for yourself, you'd worry a little bit less. I'm in decent health, you know, but obviously when you're when you've also got your responsibilities towards your family and stuff like that, it makes you nervous, you know. I do really want to play. I mean, I've never played, you know, even as a professional, I was never somebody who played all the time. You see somebody like Magnus, who you feel could happily play 365 days a year, every type of chess, and be happy. I'm not that sort of person, but I do enjoy the whole process of getting ready for a game and going there and then, you know, putting in your preparation and tricking people in time trouble, that sort of thing. Yeah, all the stuff you can't get just out of analysis, you know. Hopefully it'll happen sometime.
Yeah, I hope so too. But I echo what you're saying about the need to be cautious right now, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Matthew, if we just have one more question, if we could get to it rapid fire.
Course. No problem.
Awesome. Thank you. And this one is from Manuel Tur, who says he bought Chess for Life after reading about it in Game Changer, and it's become one of his all-time favorite chess books. And as I've mentioned before, it's about adult improvement, so definitely recommend it for inspiration and insights to any listeners. And Manuel writes, the Carlsbad structure features prominently in Matthew's book on the Queen's Gambit Declined, in Chess for Life, and in Game Changer. And what is it about this structure that fascinates you so much?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, the fascination for it came from Mark Dorecki. I mean, I've told this story about, you know, how he said, what do you know about the Carlsbad structure? And I said, well, you know, and then he said, let me tell you, you know, and 5 minutes of complete historical survey, all the plans. And, you know, it really opened up to me, you know, how you could understand something, you know, and what you would need and the whole breadth of what you could have to understand something. I mean, you know, so in some way that, you know, this Carlsbad structure is sort of talismanic for me. I mean, it was an example to me of how deep chess knowledge can get. And I think that's why I've kept on coming back to it. But also, you know, the breadth of plans and the breadth of styles and the stuff that you can do with it is incredible. You know, it's just this structure, and then all the great players have played it, and all of them have had their own, you know, tweak on it and their own way of playing it. And you know, you've got the minority attack, you've got the central attack that Botvinnik always chose. Karpov always did some sort of minority attack, but in an odd way, and somehow it always worked. AlphaZero, you know, suddenly started attacking like a lunatic on the king side, which I've never seen before. And, you know, it's there is really so much richness to it. And I think, you know, Yeah, you know, it's also for me a big example of the richness of chess, that, you know, a pawn structure like that, and you know, there's so many different ways of playing it, so many different ways of approaching it, so much subtlety in how you need to react to White's queenside play, and it's kind of talismanic for me. But it started with Dvoretsky, which, as I said before, it was a huge. Such a huge moment in my chess career, you know, and somehow that structure keeps him living within me, I think.
Excellent. And again, more on that experience can be found in our first interview. Well, Matthew, I want to thank you for being so generous with your time. This has been amazing. So many insights about everything ranging from the World Championship match to chess longevity to engines, of course. So the book is called Silicon Road to Chess Improvement. Also strongly recommend all of Matthew's other books, often in collaboration with Natasha Regan. Anything to add, Matthew, before we wrap things up here?
No, I mean, it's just, the point about the book really is to try and make chess engines, you know, useful for us to use, and also to try and get a sense of the, you know, enjoyment and the human value that working with engines can have, you know. And I think we tend to only look at engines as correcting marking, correcting a test somehow, you know, oh, you did it right, you did it wrong. But I think it can also help to generate all the feelings and all the emotions and all the material that you need in order to play chess well practically, you know. And that's really what the book is about. I'm tremendously enthusiastic about engine chess, but it also comes, you know, about because I've used so much of it in my own play, and I think it's really, you know, helped me. So yeah, you know, hopefully people will enjoy that as well. It's and I think, you know, in any case, I think it gives a nice introduction as well to engines in general. And I think, you know, the role of engines is only going to keep on growing in chess, and I think it's very important to keep up with that, so that you can keep up with the whole breadth of chess as it develops.
Yeah, well said. And I imagine you're going to stay on this beat, Matthew, the engine beat.
Yeah. No, it's too fascinating, you know, and too many interesting things happening to give it up. So, but yeah, and obviously, you know, thrilled to follow, you know, great human chess like the World Championship as well. You know, that's that is still the ultimate thrill. But the nice thing then is that you can use engines to, you know, to deepen your understanding of it and give you, you know, insight that you would. Normally, you would have had to wait, you know, years for it before, and now you can get it, you know, so quickly.
Okay, well, the chess world is richer for your explanations and your keeping track of it and sharing it with everyone. So, thank you, and we should give one last plug to your YouTube channel, also called The Silicon Road to Chess Improvement, where Matthew is doing free, obviously, little snippets of things he picked up from engines and stuff from the World Championship and so on. So, Matthew, this has been great. Hope to do it again someday if you Brilliant. Can find the
Fantastic.
Find the time to write another book somehow. But greatly appreciated, and have a good night. Oh.
Thanks very much indeed. Thanks, Ben.
Perpetual Chess is proud to be a member of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Be sure to check out their sports and pop culture related podcasts as well. I also, as always, would like to thank Matthew Passy for producing the show. Without Matthew, Perpetual Chess would not exist. And I want to thank everyone who listens to the show, whether it be on your own without telling anyone about it, keeping it secret, or if you're helping to spread the word, all the better, whether it be telling a friend about a particularly impactful interview or whether it be writing a positive review online, all of that stuff helps get the word out and helps Perpetual Chess continue to grow. But most of all, of course, I want to thank those that provide financial support to Perpetual Chess. Without you all, Perpetual Chess would not be possible in its current form. And I would like to give special thanks to the following people and entities. Here comes the list. Chessable.com, David Lazarus of Lasman Chess, coach of Dave's Young Tigers on Lee Chess, Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, the Abysmal Depths of Chess blog, Adaptive Interactive Web Designs and Services, the Apprenchess Twitch channel, Anidi Deer, Austin Clough, Benjamin Porteau, Bill Sigler, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, the Charlotte Chess Center, the Chess Central's Chess Blog, Chessmood.com, Chris Flanagan, Chris Lott, Dan O'Hanlon, Daniel He, Danny Davidson, David Mitchell. I am Dimitri Schneider, Douglas Wilson. I am Eric Rosen, Farhan Tharwar, Faraz Sawaf, Gary Foreman, Glenn Downing, Greg Harfst, Greg Shahadi, Gregory Golick, Hampus Axelson, James Kennedy, Jay Garrison, Jeff Martinson, Jeff Schaefer, Jeremy Nielsen, John Jernigan, John MacArthur, Kevin Forsyth, Kevin Gilmore, Kevin O'Callaghan, Kevin Pryor, King Cell, the King's Crusher YouTube channel, the Law Offices of Stuart Katz, Matthew Feeney, Michael Kahn, FM Michael Oplin, Mr. Mike Shahadi, Michael Sullivan, the famous Mr. Dodgy, the Nerd Nays Twitch channel, Perry McManus, GM Peter Prohaska, Peter Sodi, Philip Vlummins, the Playmore Chess Academy of the Hamden Chess Club, Ray Lillywhite, Reuven Fisher, Rick Rivas, Robert Hansen, Ross Crossland, the Seattle Chess Club, Shane Unger, Stefan Kelty, Steven Martinez, Sven Gierson, Thomas Tachenko, Todd Bryant of StrongChess.com, Todd Kennedy, The Vintage Patsers, which is a Chess.com improver group, Wayne Beam, and I also would like to thank the following, hashtag ChessPunks, who are the adult improvers on Chess Twitter, Ace Vallega, Adam Fowler, Adam Johansson, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adrian Gutierrez, Al Hastings, Alan and Maggie Sue, Alex Pejas, Alexander Markovitz, Antonio Cancino, Antonio Leonfort, FM Andre Tarakov, Dr. Andrew Perry, Angus McLeod, Barry Hessian, Bill Gruber, Bill Juniper, Bill Moran, Bill Trammell, Brad and Andy Rosen, Brandon Halseed, Brian Chase, Brian Mullis, Bruce Scott, Bruno Johnson, Brian Tillis of Palm Beach Chess, Cameron Davis, Ken Kabadayi, Chad Hilton, Chad Likens, of Rose City Chess in Portland, the Chess Dojo, Chess for Charity Jacksonville, Chess Patser Spain, Dr. Charles Snodgrass, Chris Kiefer, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Shabri, Christopher Wood, I am Christoph Zalecki, aka Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Costa Carras, Courtney Fry, Craig Mallon, Daniel Ginsberg, Daniel Naylor, Dave Best, Dave Saylor, David Blaskacek, David Brown, David Gores, David Hamblin, David Cramley, David Peterson, Dennis Parrish, FM Donnie Ariel, Dwayne Edmonds, Ed Daly, Ed Mead, Edwin Rodriguez, Eric Baldwin, Ethan Smith, Evan Rosenberg, Ewan Richardson, Ian Mason, Felipe Mayo Perea, Fox Valley Chess Club, Francis Letard Lavoie, Frank Tortoris, MD, Frank Zananis, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Gautam Narula, Gene Stewart, George Foote, George Harris, Giovanni Russo, Gregory Higgins, Han Shu, Harish Srinivasan, Howard Vihan, Jacob Kovac, Jason Apollo, Jason Murray, Jacques Parry, James Aspinwall, James Benastia, James Muir, Jason Woolham, Jay Tuttle, Jaydeep Chakrabarty, Jeff Anderson, Jeff Davis, Jeffrey Martello, Yep Hoyland, Jerry Wells, Jesse DeCumos, Jesse McNulty, Jim Jones, Jim Ratliff, Jim Sadler, Joe DeSano, Joe Valdez, Joel Thomas Ramos, John McAdams, John Tully, Juan Almaguer, Dr. John Fallon, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman, John Jeffrey, John McMurtry, Jonathan Bannister, Jonathan Slater, John Quist, John Tully, Jose Rodriguez, Justin Gardner, Justin Goodfellow, Jen Shahadi, Joel Rocky, John Thompson, Grandmaster Josh Friedel, I am Kari Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Kyle McAvoy, Larry Cook, Larry Reiferth, Lars Wiesen, Macaulay Peterson, Maria Emelyanova, a.k.a. PhotoChess, Mark Chaves, Mark Fitzpatrick, Mark Miller, Mark Wilkins, Marco Butolovich, Martin Knudsen, Martin Krug, Matt Ferrari, Matthew Coughlin, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, Matthias Plock, Mechanics Institute Chess Club of San Francisco, Michael Allard, Michael Hudson, Mike Clem, Mitchell Fabian, Nate Gobel, Nate Solon, Neil Bruce, Nigma Malajanov, Nicholas Isabel, Olaf Mueller Michaels, Pablo Davila, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passon, and Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Eckert, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Queenside Management Limited in Switzerland, Randall Montgomery, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Richard Hallenbach, Richard McCormick, Richard Tucker, Robert Callahan, Robert Turner, Robert Wall, Robert Wilson, Rory Coleman, Ryan Berg, Samson Teaches Chess, Satyajit Malagu, the Say Chess YouTube channel and publishing empire, Scott McKinnon, Scott Rose, Sean Krauss, Sebastian Finsterwater, Sergey Makagon, Seth Ruzica, Seth Will, Sean Tracy, Silver Knights in Richmond, Simon Schmidt, Stefan Roller, Stephen Miller and Tom George, WGM Tatya Vabrahamian, Terry King, Thomas Brown, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, FM Timothy Wall, Tobiah Rex, Tom Edsel, Tommy Farron, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Victor Beauchamp, William Brock, William Peterson, FM Zhao Cheng of Chess1000.com, Zachary Hoskin, and Zhivkor Stoyanov. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Podcast Network.